That a few things there that luckily lead into just something I was taking notes on. That idea of the poem as ambitious, your appreciation of common language, but also your use of more specialised languages. So one of your colleagues and another one of my teachers at Michigan, Keith Taylor, I would talk to him on occasion about the fact that I was using a lot of scientific and geological mm-hmm. terms in ephemeral waters. And he was warning off sort of making too many metaphors instead of using the technical language, because as poets, you want to have the access to the whole language, was the way he put it.
Yeah.
You want to make use of the whole language. And in your work, you do use a lot of technical languages. So, as I said, slate mining is the one that
right.
came to mind, is when you talked about loving to research a field because you get to use shop talk.
Shop talk's the best talk.
Or in Make Falcon.
Yeah.
Your falconry language, which now that H for Hawk is such a hit, everyone is into falconry, but you were there first. In the medical, the scientific, in the most recent poems in the New and Selected, a lot more technological language. The internet is present, and we're Googling and getting adware and all sorts of things. So I think, how do you research and find the right language constellation that fits with this ambition and that thing that you take off, the moment of caring that sends the poem into its future?
That's a good question. I should say I don't go shopping for language to poach, although that was a mixed metaphor, wasn't it? I do think being alert to opportunities for stealing is something that every writer must be. I sometimes think I simply get captured. Well, language is where so much of it starts. So sometimes a poem will actually start with a phrase. And sometimes it's just a piece of mysterious language, something I have no idea now. I can't recover how I started researching, if that's what you... I mean, it was too fast and loose and undisciplined to be called research, but how I started digging around trying to find out about slate mining. But I came upon a series of interviews with men who had worked in Collie Weston, this particular kind of mine, and they had amazing vocabulary for being underground, for when the mine was about to collapse, for what the rock would sound like, for just incredible things, and for their tools and routines of the workday. And it's that specialized, the way people who have work to do, business to conduct, stuff to manage, start talking to one another, the kinds of shorthand, the sorts of familiarity that calls upon, has always been moving to me. I love its textures. Sometimes it'll be a piece of language that's particularly debased, and God knows that's in the air all around us, especially as election seasons heat up in my country.
Don't talk about super
gets bad.
I can't.
It gets bad.
You don't know how much I've been reading.
It gets bad. So sometimes it's unpacking where language has, been deliberately emptied out for a certain kind of manipulative purposes. It'll be a hook. It'll be something that captures my attention one way or another. And there is a challenge always. One doesn't want to sink into opacity. So sometimes there's a way of, or to be too dependent on the prosthesis of endnotes. So sometimes it's trying to find ways of using terms that can explain themselves in context. Did that address your question at all?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I feel like that use of specialized fields of language, especially like metaphors that carry through, and then the mix of that with common language, again, it is something that I feel like, you know, does come out of, for instance, Shakespeare, where you do get all of these intense, like, here is the law lexicon,
exactly,
here is the science of the day, and then your poems are often frequently political, whether it's your interest in the scientific concerns or the title poem in The Selvage with would you be willing to tell us who you plan to vote for, we say, and she turns around with Everett. Who are we voting for? The black guy, says Everett. The black guy, she says, except that wasn't the language they used. They used the word we've all agreed to banish from even our innermost thoughts, which is when I knew he was going to win. Which is a nicer narrative than this year's narrative. So you've got that very plain language. You've got overheard language, as in the poem Target. Then that, you know, is this correctly translated even, that I am happy?
Right. Ooh. Yeah, yeah.
And that it comes in from a very political and very media-saturated dialogue as well, such that you're configuring all of these things. That also seems like a configuration of your life as a scholar and your life as a person in the world, an embodied person with this scholarly mind that happens to live in that poor brain that's part of the body too. I mean, I guess I wanted to just ask more broadly what that relationship between your scholarly work and your creative work is. I mean, a lot of people here are engaged in both sides of that argument. We all balance them in different ways and have them inform our work in different ways. Obviously writing contemporary poetry and studying and writing about poetry that was once contemporary and is always contemporary in our hearts. That they feed into each other and also provide relief from each other.
Right.
So could you speak a little bit about how they come together and tear apart?
Well, it was a big breakthrough for me when I discovered periodically I'll be working on something and hit a point where I say, oh my God, do I really want to continue working on this as a scholarly essay, or should I just trash that and start doing a sequence of poems? It was a great breakthrough when I thought, I think I'll do both. I think I'll use it for both purposes. And the new poems in here are Ovidian. I mean, they draw upon the Metamorphoses. And that simply began. I'd been asked to give a lecture at a conference where an organization about the reception of the classics was organizing. A section was organized by that organization, and Ovid was the topic, and so I was rereading Ovid for that purpose. But I got re-enchanted, so I dutifully, I produced my essay, my lecture, but I also started on this sequence. I think for me, rather than the way it feels from the inside is not so much that the poetry and the critical analytical work nurture one another, but rather that each siphons off some movements of mind that would unduly weigh down the other. I don't want to write literary criticism that gets poetic. And I don't want to write poetry that cannot give up certain forms of analytical pursuit. And so at a certain point, they are branching modes of discovery and allowing one to go its own way, knowing that I don't have to have given up the other way, just sectioned it off, is a big help. I think it keeps, of course, there are internal signs. There are habits of association or unfolding that are common to both, and probably the older I get, the more I just let it be that way. But still, there would be wrong contaminants, cross-contaminants. And so it's very useful for me to have two ways to go, even with a single set of engagements.
And I'll ask one more question before giving you guys the opportunity, but I wanted to think about the fact that, you know, you're a teacher in an MFA program, and this here is writing in society, and a lot of you here are here to study the creative side of writing, even as we feel that tension between the creative and critical as not necessarily being entirely divided. Like, there is a mingling as well. I don't want to address that old chestnut of can writing be taught. who cares? But rather ask, what is valuable about the role of the institution in writing, and what might be its limitations in your view?
Yeah. I deeply believe in writing workshop as a method for a certain phase of one's trajectory. Not that it has to happen for all writers, not that that's the only way to go, but I've seen again and again and again its great utility, that it can simply expedite a certain period of development. And for multiple reasons, perhaps the chief, it's good to get feedback. It's good to witness other possibilities. It's like, oh, yeah, right. You don't have to do all your lines flush left. Oh, right. You can change voice. You can change pitches of diction midstream. And there's a way to make that work. There's that. But I actually think the most extraordinary utility of the workshop as a pedagogical method has to do with becoming, it's a very efficient method of becoming more limber as a reader and editor. You can get good fast. You can get good. Now, and I can't say that about any other form of writing. Some people seem to get good fast as scholars or poets or fiction writers. I wouldn't know about that. To me, it's all a slower labor. But you can get good fast as a reader and analyst and critic. You really can, of work in progress. You can find ways of allowing yourself to submit to signals and imperatives for which, to begin with, you don't have a vocabulary. You can train yourself to recognize internal dynamics, to experiment with forms of elision and revision and augmentation and so forth in other people's work, because it's not, you don't have the same investment. You're not in danger of being humiliated every other minute or having to give up the one thing that tied you to your beloved grandmother. And so it's, right, it's a freer space for development, and it can happen fast. And A, when you're working really hard to write your own novel or write your own poems or write your own nonfiction essay, it's a great relief and consolation prize to have another thing where you can see steady improvement, even if it's not the thing that you count as the prize or the goal. The other thing is that all those skills then come in really handy with your own work when you do hit stride. So I deeply believe in it. The other thing, frankly, community's nice, right? Just having somebody say, have you read? Because writing is pretty solitary for most of us. And then, for the same reason that universities are good for scholarship, they've come increasingly to be good for fiction and poetry as a default patronage system. People lodge there. People lodge there as a way of, you know, sustaining a writing habit. You go there and you got someplace you can maybe earn enough to pay the rent. And we don't have other structures. We don't have courts that do it. We do not, certainly in my country, we don't have central arts councils and things that on anything like the scale that more enlightened cultures have sometimes had. And so so all of that is good. The dangers are becoming too insular, getting to forgetting that the audience for one's work is not always going to be a command audience. That is, it's not, the people in the room aren't always going to have been required to read your stuff. And that comes to matter, too, because we do, you know, on the one hand, it's a great treasure to have this generous, to be the object of the focus of generous attention week after week. But one had better remember that, or one will, in very difficult circumstances, find oneself discovering that that will not always be the case. I think, you know, so therefore possibly forgetting that poetry and fiction and the popular essay, certain kinds of criticism, ought to remain urgent to other human beings. And therefore,
bureaucracies can make things feel less urgent.
Yeah.
Feel a bit numb. I wanted to give the audience the opportunity to ask questions, and then as if Linda was going to read one more poem for us before the end, that I'll throw it open.
Again, amazed by your voice. It's such richness. I feel that like you're carrying your own cello. There's the echo, just amazing. You talk about embodiment. I want to ask a question. To what extent writing poetry itself is an embodied experience?
Oh, I think it is very much. That, you know, poetry cannot be stasis. It's not exactly, you know, nailing something down. But it is, to my mind, finding or allowing the growth into a body of words of, or by means of a body of words, the development of perception is a way of, like this body, that body is a means of inhabiting mortality. That's why I say it's not static. I mean, it would be great if, you know, one would always like one's work to live a little longer. But it's not permanent so much. It's just, it's slowing down the rush of oblivion. So something crafted, developed in words into the form and body of a poem is that much. That's at least its decline into oblivion is slowed down just that much. There's, I will have been there. I will have noticed. It's a sign that something, you know, will have been. Not that before it joins the generality of never having been. And I do think the materiality of words, their fleshiness, the way they can be delicious on the tongue, they can be chewy, they can be smooth, they can be difficult, they can involve impediment, that all of those are good for thought, because they build in a kind of resistance. Again, that very toothiness of language, which is its material body, is just something that gets in the way of free flow. And I think that's a good thing. I experience that as a good thing. Thank you for that question. Yeah.
Just a comment, actually. I just want to say how useful I thought what you said about that very simple thing about not paraphrasing.
Oh, good.
Really quite revelationary, actually, because I can get back to my old self, but I'm tussling with prose poetry, and I'm always sort of wandering around at the limits going, when does this, you know, stop being a poem? And it's sort of a question that eats away at me rather than...
Yeah.
And I just thought that edict was really fantastic, and it hit a kind of instinctive nerve with me about the paraphrase.
I'm so glad. I'm so glad. Yeah, because it, again, you know, if it's even if there's enormous concision, elegance of phrasing, accuracy of image, all of that stuff, if it has been constructed as packaging for understanding or apprehension had off the page, it will forever remain that. It will be a garment or packaging. It won't be the living thing. Again, no matter how economically and artfully constructed.
And then Peter.
Can I just follow on from that? So, I mean, I'm always interested in how people write and what their methods are. And I mean, you've already said a certain amount about that, but how do you guard against, first of all, how do you guard against paraphrasing? What are your methods? I mean, I know that, you know, I would have certain methods, but... for not doing that, I agree, that's pretty sort of critical that you don't, it's not just a paraphrase, it's something that you have.
Yeah, but like, what does that mean?
So, yeah, how do you avoid it in a way, and what are your methods? And also this business of, which I also agree with, that somewhere on the line you have to find something else.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really, that to me is quite critical as well, because in a way it's a way of saying there's no good poem that isn't a multi-layered poem in a way. You know, you're always going to find something else. But so, also, how do you induce that? I mean, do you just sit around waiting for another idea to come, or
yeah,
do you actually quite consciously,
yeah,
try and,
yeah,
find something?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I'm just a bit, you know, interested in those two things. How you
Thank say. You. Well, in terms of method, if it can be called that. I actually don't particularly recommend this as a method, but I'll tell you what I'm now stuck with, because I actually don't see this changing, is that I write poems in sequence, that which is to say I revise massively, but I revise as I go along. That is, I will endlessly mess with the first five lines of a poem. Meaning sometimes it's just, they're completely wrong. It's just got all the language has to go. Sometimes the angle of approach is wrong, and it just has to, sometimes the speed of approach is wrong. Sometimes the pitch of diction, the voicing, the sort of point of view, place from which the poem begins, or speaker position is wrong. But I will fuss and with the first five lines, seven lines, forever, and they have to be actually quite meticulously in place before I go on to the next three or four, and then all of that has to get completely before I'll do the. And the reason it seems ridiculous as a way of proceeding, but what I've found for me is that if I do a looser draft, which is what I used to do way back when, and go back and revise, I kill the poem. It gets dead because it knows where it's going.
This is the music to my ears. I don't believe in this thing of drafting.
So again, I do the I might spend, I can easily spend a 4 or 5 hour morning messing with line breaks in a seven line sequence. And at the end of that 5 hours, come back to the exact line breaks I had. And that's progress, because I know that the other options aren't options, that they're wrong for various reasons. And so that this is the one. That's a morning's work sometimes. So it's not about like whatever I write is golden and stays that way on the page. On the contrary, but I just, when there's anything like overview or the next few moves, when I know that that's where I'm going, I kill it. I kill it. It gets ironed out in a weird way. The knowingness of it, the balance between anticipation and moving forward. So bizarrely, on the one hand, it seems like a formula for overworking, but for me, it's the only method of actually preserving surprise, the possibility of surprise. I need surprise. I need to turn a corner and, be in a new landscape, or hit the wall, or like be in danger of falling off the cliff on my bicycle. And I just need those turns into sheer unknownness, line after line after line after line. So that's how I work. You asked another part of the question.
Well, I just asked this business of trying to find something else.
Right.
Whether you try and consciously induce that something.
Well, sometimes it's again, sometimes it's a deer with a terrible headshot wound walking across my lawn, and that being actually the only thing in the world, and it's got to fuck. So
would you go looking for things? That's what I mean.
Well, no. Sometimes I may be walking around in a state of despair, and things find me. I mean, I may be on the, it's sort of that, a newspaper headline, a this or that, or a tone of voice, or an encounter, or a shift of mood, and think, no, there's something about that, and it's often very intuitive that there's a, I don't know how I'm going to make this be the continuation, but I'll try it. So that it's not always serial. It's not always linear. Almost never linear progression. I giving myself the freedom to think of a poem as a series of juxtapositions. And sometimes I'm just not sure for a while whether this place I went is actually going to belong in the poem. I'm trying to think for the sake of an honest answer, whether sometimes something that just seems like, you know, that came in under the radar or from off the screen or whatever metaphor we're going for here, if sometimes I find I have to reject that because it's just too far afield or I can't find a link. I don't know that that often happens. I think sometimes maybe my instinct is simply something not about connection, but that it is refreshingly of a difference. And then I find a way. Or maybe then I find a third that retroactively makes it seem to have been a way.
Seems like you also, when you get to that point that you know you need to go elsewhere, that you might switch into a different mode of attentiveness, such that you
own
that what crosses your path is this intuitively the thing, and that attentiveness, once you're sort of outside of that, the thing that you've already achieved, is a way of going looking without going looking.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what the only thing I can understand about the muse, what has possessed human beings in some places and times to invent a thing they call the muse, is that feeling that something happened while you weren't looking. And I think part of that is giving yourself, and that's the usefulness of the stanza form to me,
yes,
too, is that if you give yourself enough to do, if you've got some practical puzzle solving, I mean, I think that's what poetic form is good for anyway, whether you're working in traditional rhyme and meter or whether it just happens to be the relatively flexible constraints of a three-line stanza, that if you give yourself enough productive labor to do, there's a kind of thinking that can more felicitously happen because it's not front and center. Thank you.
Peter, you have?
I was just interested in almost the other side of this idea of not paraphrasing, because it struck me reading, discovering your poems and being bowled over them by a few days ago, just so wonderful.
I'm so glad, thank you.
Part of what seems so wonderful, I came in, you know, sort of expecting to not like them with a prejudice against America. But I was bowled over. And part of what bowled me over, I think, was their openness, like kind of like Shakespeare, their openness to wisdom. Mm-hmm. That they were open to common wisdom, they were open to taking that risk of letting emotion and real life be fully in there. They didn't seem like something purely abstract or abstracted, or trying to avoid the risk of becoming sentimental, but obviously not sentimental. And I wondered whether that training or that long familiarity, I'm sure, with Shakespeare fed into that. Have you got any thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, thank you in the first instance. Those are extremely kind words. Shakespeare is my book. I mean, I spend a lot of my life with that work, and it's generosity, it's capaciousness, it's refusal to have contempt for the common forms is the core of its genius, I think. Shakespeare loves, he delights in all sorts of strenuousness, but he's not above humble pleasures. And that never gets old. It never gets old. So I hope in some tiny way that's a generosity I've maybe fragmentarily learned to emulate.
Do you see a tension between what I've just talked about and the obvious desire that poetry should surprise, that poetry should both be wise and should surprise? Do you find that tension, or do you find that...
That's very interesting. I think wisdom... I think what poetry longs to do, I think its grandest ambition, my grandest ambition for it, is to prompt recognition. And I think that appeals to, I think that includes both surprise and wisdom, in the sense of one comes to something and it's the freshness of formulation, the angle of encounter, something about it makes it new enough to be noticed, and yet one says, yes, exactly. I've known that before. I knew that before. I had, you know how sometimes people will say, right, I've just never been able to put it so well, or so, but that's recognition to see something new, learned, acquired, old, whatever, and with the feeling, I'm coming home. I'm coming home. It's a recognition, and another way of putting it is it's an apprehension of wisdom, because it's an apprehension of justness. Yes, just so. I feel at home there. And I think, but again, we don't feel that if something is, if it's a delivery system for wisdom that is too familiar, because then we just feel jaded. We think, oh, that's cliche. It doesn't have the energy of recognition. It's just business as usual. So I think you're on to exactly the collision that is ever to be hoped for, and probably very rarely generated, but ever to be hoped for. Should we do the one last poem?
Yeah, one last poem.
Well, it's different, this one. And this one is, I'm afraid, we're in the realm of neurophysiology, but this is a love letter, actually, this poem, to a particular body of work. I wrote this poem on assignment. I am very... Did you know that?
No.
I wrote it on assignment. I love having to write poems on assignment. Sometimes it's the only poem I write that year. Morris Reardon and John Burnside, a wonderful Irish and a wonderful Scottish poet, got some money from a foundation in the UK to put together an anthology of poems, some of which were pre-existent in the world, most of which were pre-existent in the world, but some of which would be commissioned from English language poets all over, maybe 8 of us, 10 of us. This was to be a volume in commemoration of some anniversary of the publication of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. So we were given this tiny bit of money and told it was a sort of take a scientist out to dinner, poets. Find a friend, enter into conversation. And really, literally the money was just, it was very, it's a very modest honorary. And I thought, what am I going to do? Oh, my God. And my brother-in-law said, I know exactly what you should do. This was years ago, some years ago. He said, the Nobel Prize in Physiology last year was given to this incredible body of work. And... it involves all, decades of work by this group of three folks. So this is the Nobel Prize in Physiology. It was awarded, this is 2002, awarded to Sidney Brenner, Robert Horvitz, and John Sulston for discoveries concerning, quote, genetic regulation of organ development and programmed cell death, end quote. The counterintuitive discovery was essential to morphological development is programmed death, cell death. So, for example, the way fingers get formed in the fetus, first there's this kind of blob, and then the flesh gets eaten away, and so you actually have digits. And they discovered, they used this terrific microscopic roundworm called Caenorhabditis elegans. This little, because it was complex enough to be significant and simple enough to be observed. What the observation entailed. And they observed, this was before the genome had been mapped. So this was essential work on the way to genome mapping. And what they did is they mapped cell differentiation in the fully mature roundworm from the first division. They marked where every single cell went. And what they discovered was that some lines died out and were programmed to die out. And that's how the roundworm differentiated, how it got a nerve, a central nerve, how it got a digestive system, how it got reproductive parts. And so it was so incredibly cool. It turns out, A, that they were just giving, the Nobel ceremony was just about to happen, and one of these scientists was so kind as to share his Nobel speech, the draft of his speech, with me. But one of the people who were just back then from Sweden and the ceremony was a colleague of mine at Michigan, and he invited me into his lab, and he set up, you know, microscopes, and he gave me whiteboard presentations, and he spent a day basically tutoring me in this stuff and gave me off prints, and it was so completely sweet. And so here's my ode to the roundworm. And it's called Elegant. Dew point and a level field, or slick of agar microscope, the embryonic roundworm and an open mind. The world so rarely lets us in, let's praise the lucky vista when it does. We knew, said my tutor, that death was a part of it. Think of the webbing that's eaten away in order that you may have fingers. We didn't know. How to put this? Before we mapped our soil-borne roundworm, C for Caenor, filth, Habditus, one who dwells there, with its 1,090 invariant cells, of which 131 and always the same, and always in a particular sequence, are programmed for extinction. We had no idea how close to the heart of it death must be. At first, a sort of cratered field or granulated, see it, both the raised parts and concavities, the sculpting light, and then a sort of swelling. It's a corpse now. Then engulfment, that's the sister cell, and then the disappearance. You'll remember how the lipids lose their place. And on our chart, an X, where would be daughter cells, a fate like any other. It's a lie, of course, the light and shadow so disposed, a friendly lie, as if, as in a play. Of something less congenial to the seeing eye, the microscope makes shadow, and our question gains some traction, and the world, though not just yet and not so seamlessly, makes sense. Proprietary sequencing. Don't break my heart. We thought at first a camera would be just the thing itself in real time caught for anyone to stop and start. But that was to ignore how much the camera misses, how what we call seeing in an ever-changing depth of field, while twofold, threefold, turning on its axis, still unhatched, our worm performs its complex cleavages and differentiations, is already to have balanced on the edge of thought. What answered? What the optics, Sinomarsky, really needed on the other end was homely as the worm. A pencil, paper, one man, preternaturally good at this, and 13 hours, a little more, from founder cell to hatching. Let's say coffee, lots. And found he had transcribed there. Found that death was not an afterthought. The genome is a river, too. And simpler, far more elegant, to keep the single system and discard the extra cells it spawns. So, apo, Greek, away from, ptosis, fall, as leaves, preserve the tree by learning to relinquish it. A river of intelligence runs through us. Could the part we do on purpose do less harm? One version of the lesson is its usefulness, the kindred genes that help us break the circuit of malignancy. We name them for what happens when they fail. But use is not the whole of it. He wants, said my father, and this of one he loved, to live forever. So I knew it was contemptible, had loved forever. Death is not an afterthought, nor mother of beauty will death undone assist us. We are made of it, our cognate mother to the worm. A worthy daily labor, and this thread of in the cells remembering makes it so. Thank you.